All right, everybody, it's 1 p.m. Eastern, so we're going to get started with today's webinar, ITRC sediment cap isolation. So I'm going to cover some housekeeping rules to begin with today, and then we're going to get started with content. So this training is being recorded and will be offered on demand through Kluent for those not able to join us live. The Kluent training page that brought you here today has the training slides available for download under Download Training Materials. Please use the Q&A pod to ask any questions, to make comments, or report any technical problems that you encounter during today's training. Our attendees today will not be able to use the chat box, only the Q&A, so please keep that in mind. For those interested in receiving certificates of completion, they are available upon the completion of the feedback form at the end of the webinar. The feedback form can also be found on the Kluent training page that brought you here today. Once you complete the form, you'll click a box to certify that you participated in the training course, and then a certificate will be emailed to you after. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as Kluent. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of States. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, community. ITRC members participate in technical teams which produce tools and resources and training courses, such as the one you're participating on. If you want ITRC, we encourage you to visit our website where you can find out more about the current teams that are open for registration and participation, and how you can also become an active member. The full ITRC disclaimer is also available on our website. If you would like to use any ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, I would like to officially welcome you to today's training, ITRC Sediment Cap Isolation Guidance Document Training. This is an introduction to the ITRC online resource of the same name, produced by ITRC in 2023. On slide five, I have the pleasure of introducing our expert trainers joining us today. All of them have served as members for the sediment cap isolation team over the past 2 years and have also volunteered to support the training offered today. So all of their bios are also included on the Kluent training page that brought you here today if you would like to learn a little bit more about their backgrounds, and their emails are also listed there if you would like to reach out to any of the trainers specifically. So with that, I will be passing it off to Ashley Lesser from the Michigan Department of Environmental, Great Lakes, and Energy to get us started with a quick introduction.
Yeah. So if you look online for ITRC sediment cap guidance, you will find two different documents. There's the 2014 guidance and the 2023 guidance, which our team just released this year. I want to say we still support the 2014 guidance. It's a great resource, and it had the specific objective to provide a basic understanding about the full gamut of sediment remediation technologies, and to provide some general guidelines for making an informed remedy selection. What it didn't include was detailed information about implementation of the different sediment remedies. And for engineered sediment caps, there hasn't really been a comprehensive guidance developed, even though there's literature out there. So caps have typically been developed on a site-specific basis, with a lot of inconsistency in both the design approach and in the post-installation frameworks for evaluation. This can result in extensive negotiation between designers and regulators to reach consensus on many points. ITRC's 2023 guidance gets into those details. It focuses on the chemical isolation layer that is central to a cap's function and the design and performance criteria that influence a cap's effectiveness. It provides some thoughtful recommendations about how to work through the design, construction, and monitoring phases. I'll hand it off to Warda to share the roadmap for our training today.
Thanks, Ashley. Today's training will follow the structure of the 2023 guidance document. I'm going to briefly go over the introduction section, And the other trainers will cover the capping overview from section two of the guidance, performance objectives and design concepts from section three, chemical isolation layer modeling from section five. Then we will have a break to answer some questions before moving on to construction considerations and monitoring and maintenance from section six and seven of the guidance, followed by a final question and answer break. The graphic you see here on the right describes the process to be followed for chemical isolation design, construction, and monitoring once capping is selected as part of your remedy. You will see this graphic throughout the training as each of the trainers will go over the different components of the flowchart in more detail and identify the associated document sections. You may have noticed that section four was missing from the previous slide. Section four consists of table 4-1, which summarizes the types of data that may be needed to support chemical isolation design, construction, and monitoring. This training will not specifically cover section four of the guidance document, but section four and the aspects of table 4-1 will be touched upon throughout the training because the data needs described in this section are used for design, construction, and monitoring of the gaps. With that, I would like to pass it on to Bhavna.
All right, sediment capping objectives. So the three objectives that we have listed here. First one is the physical stabilization to prevent contaminant transport. And then second one is the chemical isolation to contain or limit contaminant migration and exposure to contaminants of concern from the underlying sediments. And the third one is protection of benthic community by preventing direct contact with the underlying contaminated sediments. Now, these objectives, they were specified in our 2014 guidance document, and they remain same in this guidance as well. So, section two, capping overview. In this section, we will go through the capping objectives and particularly the function of the chemical isolation layer itself. So the capping objectives that I just specified for physical and chemical isolation and to protect benthic community, they can be achieved by placing a single cap layer or a combination of multiple cap layers. These caps are designed to achieve a site-specific performance objectives. In some cases, a single layer cap may serve multiple functions and achieve more than one performance objective. But in some cases, a series of layers may be required. This slide presents a configuration of a multiple layer cap system. The first one from the bottom is the base layer that is placed right on top of contaminated sediment. This layer basically creates an even or a stable base on which rest of the cap layers can be placed. It prevents mixing of chemical isolation layer with the contaminated sediments, and it also adds geotechnical stability of the underlying soft sediments. In case of dredging cap, this layer may be required to stabilize dredge residuals prior to capping. And this could be a layer of sand or geotextile. Then next is the chemical isolation layer, which is the main focus of this guidance. This layer is designed to inhibit migration of contaminants from underlying sediments that generally occurs via advection, diffusion, dispersion, or bioturbation. Then on top of it is the filter layer. This layer is intended to mitigate mixing of chemical isolation layer from the upper erosion protection layer. And this layer is typically used when there is a difference in grain size between these two layers and is typically constructed using medium-sized grain material or geosynthetics that serves as a transition layer. Then erosion protection layer. This layer is intended to protect the physical integrity of chemical isolation layer from the erosive forces that can be caused by waves, tides, currents, heavy vessel traffic, ice scour. And it is constructed from a range of coarse grain material or other manufactured material. Then habitat restoration layer. This is the uppermost layer that accommodates the benthic community after recolonization. In some cases, chemical isolation layer or erosion protection layer is suitable for this purpose, but in some cases, a distinct layer is incorporated in the cap design. And here in this figure, you can see BAZ, which is the top surface of the cap or sediment. This is basically the biologically active zone. And I just wanted to bring it to your attention because it will be referred in this training throughout. So this guidance document is mainly focused on the design of chemical isolation layer. However, it is important for us to understand the entire cap configuration because these different cap layers, they do contribute to the design of the chemical isolation layer. And that will be covered in the training as well. So do we need all the layers in a multiple cap layer system? Maybe, maybe not. And here we can see a range of cap configuration that can be applied depending on the site conditions. In some cases, a base layer may not be required for habitat layer. If we have chemical isolation layer or erosion protection layer material that is suitable for habitat, then a distinct layer may not be required. Similarly, for filter layer, a requirement is evaluated based on the design of chemical isolation layer and erosion protection layer. For erosion protection, if the site has high energy environment, we may need a robust erosion protection. But for the sites with low energy environment, we may or may not require an additional layer for protection. Then the configuration to the far right, this one is a single layer cap system where unamended cap may be used to provide a distance separating the contaminants from and the receptors. And in this case, the single layer may serve multiple functions. General cap types, the three most commonly referenced cap types are unamended granular cap, low permeability caps, and amended caps. Unamended granular caps, they are typically constructed with inert materials such as sand, stone, or other natural materials. And these are permeable in nature. These caps are generally intended to provide physical separation, and they also increase the attenuation thickness. They reduce diffusive flux and accumulation of contaminants in the biologically active zone. Low permeability caps, they are typically constructed of clay-based materials, mixture with Portland cements or geosynthetic liners. These materials are designed to provide a relatively impermeable or low permeability barrier that reduces the advective flux of contaminants. And these caps provide physical separation and impedes flow of pore water and migration of contaminants. Amended caps. Now, these caps can consist of a wide range of reactive amendments. These caps are typically permeable. They allow upward flow of pore water and they retard chemical migration. So they provide both physical isolation and chemical isolation. And the selection of amendments, that depends on the type of contaminants in sediments. For organic contaminants, typically activated carbon and organophilic clay-based amendments are used, where activated carbon can address dissolved concentrations and organophilic clay can address any NAPL-impacted sediments. And for the sites with heavy metals, amendments such as apatite, zeolite, or siderite are typically used. And these amendments, there are different placement techniques, how these amendments can be placed. These can be mixed with granular materials such as sand, or they can be applied in bulk in formulations that are commercially available, or they can be even filled in geotextile and placed in mat-based forms. And there are cap models available. There will be one discussed later in the training that has capability to evaluate these different amendments and even commercially available formulations. Cap design considerations. This slide illustrates four critical design factors. They'll be discussed in detail in the subsequent sections, but I'll quickly go through them here. Chemical design criteria. It is important for the design of chemical isolation layer. We need to know type of contamination for selection of amendments, level of contamination and hydrodynamic conditions. They drive the thickness of chemical isolation layer. Then physical design constraints. We need to understand site settings, navigational requirements, geotechnical consideration, if there is a presence of any debris or a structure that we need to consider, any particular habitat requirement that may or may not require a separate layer design. Then other important design considerations, including understanding of hydrodynamic conditions, erosion potential, and slope stability. We also need to know and understand any permitting requirements or any ARRs applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements. And lastly, constructability. It is important that CAP can be constructed as designed and is specified. And with that, I pass it on to Deirdre.
Thanks, Bhavna. So as Bhavna showed, there are different CAP types and CAP configurations with different amendments that may be needed to meet your site goals. In focusing on the chemical isolation layer and defining the configuration, the thickness that we need, or the amendment type, or if we need an amendment, how much do we need, we often turn to modeling. And modeling will be discussed in the next section. But before we get into the modeling, we have to make some decisions. And that process typically starts with an understanding of your design criteria. That is, what are you designing your CAP to protect? So in this section, I'm going to spend quite a bit of time talking about the defining your design criteria and then getting into some of the other considerations that you need to be aware of. When we talk about performance targets, the goal, or you know, you may hear of it as referred to as the Remedial Action Objective, or RAO, is to reduce the risk to human health and ecological receptors. As you can see from these examples of the human health and ecological risk receptors in the box on the bottom, they're quite broad in nature. You know, risks, reduce risks to adults and children from incidental ingestion and dermal exposure, or consuming contaminated fish and shellfish, reducing environmental toxicity to benthic organisms or higher trophic organisms. So again, those are broad, but when we design a CAP, we need to be specific. We need to be more quantitative. That's where design criteria come into play. And the components of a design criteria, they answer the questions what, where, and when. So looking at this list, the what, that's your concentrations or fluxes. What is the concentration you need to meet or the flux that you need to meet for your CAP to be protective? Then we get into the where. So at what depth does the chemical isolation performance target apply? And we call that the point of compliance. We also have to consider spatial scales when we consider the where. So is it a SWAC over a specified area, or do we need to meet those concentrations at that depth on a point-by-point basis? And then finally, we get into the when. That's the time frame the chemical isolation performance targets apply, and we call that the design life. So on this slide, I'm showing three examples of performance targets, and you'll notice that they answer those questions, the what, the where, and the when. So the first one, for example, the pore water concentration of contaminant X shall not exceed 1 nanogram per liter. That's the what. At a depth of 10 centimeters from the CAP surface. And that's the where. And then over 100 years is the when. So you'll see that how that compares to those RAOs. These are definitely more specific. They're more quantitative. So at this time, I'd like to hear from you. What issues have you encountered when establishing remedial goals for CAP design? You should see a poll to, put in your answer. So please use that and type that in, and we'll kind of see what you all have to say. Deirdre, I just want to let you know that I'll probably keep it open for another 30 seconds, and then I'll broadcast results.
Okay, great.
So in the next few slides, I'll go through some of the complicating factors when considering design targets. I'll start with one on our next slide that talks about the uncertainty in design criteria that are based on the solid phase concentrations for organocarbon organic compounds. So let's see. And Devin, how did the poll show?
So I'll have to read some of the answers because they were short answers. So
Okay.
of the answers, we have things like cost, goals weren't established, establishing vegetation to prevent erosion could have been problematic. Things like design storm criteria, goal concentration, and determining technologies that can and cannot be used.
Yes. All right. Those are all great. And I think we may not get to all of those in this training, but we will definitely get to a few of them in terms of like monitoring and where to monitor and how to monitor and what technology is available. But I'll go through a few examples of things that I've encountered over the years. So with the first one, this is something that answers that question, what? And as I mentioned, the what could be a specific concentration that we need to meet or a flux that needs to be met within the cap. For design criteria based on a concentration, we have two options. We can meet a concentration on a pore water basis or a sorb phase basis. And when evaluating performance of the cap, either during design on a pore, we find it's helpful to actually use a pore water basis. And that's because the presence of organic carbon in the cap influences the concentration on a solid phase basis. So what I'm showing on this slide are two example outputs from the cap modeling software CAPSTIM. These are actually the same exact model simulation. On the left, we're showing the output on a pore water basis, so micrograms per liter. And on the right, we're showing the output from the model on a solid concentration, so micrograms per kilogram. And so the x-axis shows shows concentration, and the y-axis shows depth, with the surface being at the top of the y-axis. So the graph on the left kind of shows us what we expect to see from a typical profile. We expect to see the highest concentrations down in our sediment, and then we expect to see the concentrations decrease as we get closer to the surface. When we look on a solid phase concentration basis, like I said, the total organic carbon that's assumed in each of these layers does have an impact. So we'll see the same thing. We start to see a decrease in concentrations as we move to the surface. And then once we get into this biologically active zone, which I've enlarged here in the circle, you'll see an increase in concentrations. And that's because there's an assumption here that in the biologically active zone, it'll likely equilibrate to, TOC that's in the nearby sediments. What we assume for that has an impact on those concentrations. So the higher the TOC in that layer, the higher this solid phase concentration will be for, again, an organic compound. And that's because organic compounds absorb more strongly to TOC. If we assumed a low TOC in this layer, this concentration would be less. And so therefore, that TOC, sort of that assumption, has an impact on what you see. We avoid that confounding effect if we look at things on a pore water basis. Another complicating factor for designing for the design criteria can be background concentrations.
In a dynamic environment, background concentrations will affect the surface of your sediment, and therefore, when you place a cap, they'll also affect the surface of your cap. So the graphic here shows a cap on sediment with no deposition. I've superimposed sort of an X and Y axis on top of this. So we have pore water concentration on the X axis and then depth from the surface on the Y axis. This magenta line shows the concentration that's in the pore water in the sediment beneath the cap. And what you'll see is over time, we see that concentration, those chemicals migrate up through the cap and towards the surface. And again, we follow that similar pattern of decreasing concentrations as we move closer to the surface. Now, we then have this graph on the right. Okay, we have this the same idea, but now we have depositing material and we have chemicals on those depositing material on that depositing material. So if those concentrations are elevated, what we'll start to see is actually the surface of our cap will start to have elevated concentrations as well. And that's because as the material deposits, the organisms in the surface start to mix that in. So knowing this can help you define maybe a more realistic design criteria if you know that your surface of your cap will re-equilibrate to background. Also, what these graphs highlight is the difference between what we call cap effectiveness and remedy effectiveness. So in both of these cases, the cap may be performing as expected, right? Concentrations are decreasing as they get closer to the surface. But in the case on the right, even though the cap may be performing as expected, the remedy may not, meaning you may not have cut off your sources. And so this remedy effectiveness versus cap effectiveness is an important distinction, particularly for long-term monitoring after the cap is constructed. And tomorrow we'll spend some time going through that later in this training. The next question we need to answer is the where. So the point of compliance is directly related to the remedial goal. So here we have a cap consists of a chemical isolation layer and an erosion protection layer that's sitting on top of sediments. For a remedial goal that's established to be protective of benthic organisms, the point of compliance is within or at the bottom of the biologically active zone. And that's because that's the zone where the benthic organisms live and feed, and that's where they will be exposed to those chemical concentrations. For a remedial goal that's established to be protective of ambient water quality criteria or fish at higher trophic levels, the point of compliance is near the cap surface where the chemicals will flux to the water column, or it could be actually in the surface water itself. Now, a related concept that is discussed in the 2023 guidance is what's called the design evaluation depth. And that is the depth at which you will design the cap to meet the criteria. Now, that could be the same as your point of compliance. And in this example, again, we're showing a cap on sediments that's being constructed to be protective of benthic organisms. So in that case, the point of compliance is in the biologically active zone. And again, the design evaluation depth can also be the same as the point of compliance. But depending on your capped environment, there may be reasons why you would choose a design evaluation depth that is different from your point of compliance. Some of those reasons include large armor stone or confounding effects from deposition. And I'll go through a few of those examples. So here's an example of a cap with large armor stone. The large armor stone, as you see here, is not likely to provide a lot of attenuation. The large pore space is more representative of the surface water, unless it fills in with depositional material. And so in this case, it may be more appropriate to evaluate the cap effectiveness below that armor stone. Now, continuing with an example of a cap that's designed to be protective of benthic organisms, once the cap is placed, Benthic organisms are going to reoccupy the top of the cap. So the biologically active zone is in the top of the cap, and that therefore the point of compliance is also in the top of the cap. But with deposition over time, so moving from the left to the right in this graphic, we're seeing increase in deposition over time. The point of compliance will then rise as the biologically active zone transitions into that newly deposited material. If that depositing material is clean, then it may contribute to natural recovery, providing additional attenuation. And in this case, you may choose that point of compliance to be the same as that design of the design evaluation depth as your point of compliance. However, you may choose a design evaluation depth that is deeper, avoiding the influence of the depositing material, and therefore assessing the effectiveness of the chemical isolation layer alone to provide attenuation. And that would happen further down into the cap. This example combines the last two concepts. So this is a case where we have large armor stone that infills from deposition. And so with the infilling, it will behave similar to the deposition example on the previous slide. All right, so now we get into answering the question of when or for how long. So the design life is the minimum period over which the cap is designed to meet the design criteria. Caps are usually designed for long-term risk reduction. So a typical design life as widely accepted is 100 years. Depending on your site and your situation, it could be shorter. But I would say 100 is pretty typical. This graphic shows an example output from CAPSIM. It shows the model predicted concentrations as the blue line at a depth of 5 centimeters from the surface of the cap over a 100-year simulation. In this example, the cap was designed to meet a criteria, which is shown as that pink line at the top. For more than 100 years. And you'll notice that the blue line is below that design criteria, even at 100 years. And it's likely expected to stay below that for more than 100 years. Just because we design a cap for 100 years or that design life, the performance life may be longer due to conservatism that's built into the design process. And there are a number of factors that can add conservatism to a design. And those are listed here. So the design criteria themselves could be conservative, and that's because we often build conservatism into the risk assessments that are used to define design criteria. When we get into the modeling, input parameters that are used in the model evaluations are usually also conservative. The parameters that have the largest influence are the groundwater seepage rates, contaminant concentrations in the pore water beneath the cap, your partitioning characteristics, and then deposition rates. So often when we design caps, we try to be conservative. We use upper bound, you know, seepage rates. We might use upper bound pore water concentrations, look at more mobile partition coefficients. We may exclude deposition rates, all of which are conservative. And then when setting the specifications for design, we specify those as minimum thicknesses and minimum doses. And in some cases, the specifications might even add a little bit of conservatism by, you know, specifying a dose that's even higher than the modeling indicated. Material placement during design, oftentimes the contractors are going to place additional quantities of material than needed. So all of these things come together to show that the performance of your cap may be longer than what you've designed it to be. So now moving into some constraints on the chemical isolation layer thickness. Now that we've gone through, you know, defining the criteria, we want to ask the question, are there any constraints on cap thickness? There could the reasons that you might have these constraints are flood control or navigation requirements. So I'm going to give an example where we're going to use navigation as an example. And so because of navigation requirements, you may need to maintain a minimum water depth. So with that minimum water depth, that only leaves you a certain amount of room for your cap. So now let's zoom in on this remaining thickness. Now what we do is we say we consider what layers are needed and then how much room we have left for the chemical isolation layer. And in the 2023 guidance, we refer to this as a top-down approach. So we have our sediment, and we may need a base layer to create an even surface. We may need an armor layer to protect the chemical isolation layer from it being eroded. And if that armor stone is large, we may also need a filter layer. And so what's left is the amount of space that you have for that chemical isolation layer. And if that space isn't enough, you may need to dredge to make more room, or you may need to add an amendment, because you can't go any thicker. So in talking about those amendments, Bhavna covered some of those. Amendments are often required to meet the performance targets. They depend on what chemicals at your site are. If you have multiple chemicals, you may need multiple types of amendments. They can be added in a discrete layer, or they can be mixed with other cap materials, such as, sand. Or they can be directly added to the sediment. While there is a lot of literature out there, you may need to collect data to help support the modeling for the design with site-specific isotherms. Finally, you may also need to consider impacts to your benthic community, and that's of particular interest if your amendment is going to be placed within the cap at a location where the benthic organisms may be exposed. So that's just something to keep in mind. And that benthic community is also important because it helps us understand our point of compliance or maybe our biologically active zone. Finally, in section 3 of the guidance, sorry, 3.4 of the guidance document, we provide a comprehensive discussion of some other considerations. I'm listing a few here, but I really encourage you to spend some time with that document because there's a lot of really good information. But we want to understand spatial differences in the site characteristics that may affect your chemical isolation layer design. That may help you optimize your cap design based on differences in chemical concentrations, presence of NAPL. Seepage rates may vary, and you may have high seepage rates in one area and low in another area. And again, that deposition and erosion protection, erosion potential. And so, by perhaps dividing up the site into areas that have higher concentrations compared to lower concentrations, you may come up with a more optimal cap design across your entire site. And then again, that benthic community structure and bioturbation. What we see often is bioturbation depths are often between 5 and 10 centimeters, but you might need site-specific data to inform your models. And again, that's really important for your point of compliance. So to wrap up, we talked about design criteria in detail. We talked about that what, the where, and the how long. With each of those components, we discussed some complicating factors that and how we could handle those. We then spoke about some design constraints with an example of the top-down approach. And then finally, we gave examples of other considerations that should be evaluated for the chemical isolation layer design. And once again, I can't stress this enough, but really go to section 3 of the 2023 guidance document for more information on that. There's just not enough time in this training to cover everything. So with that, I'm now going to pass it on to Danny Reibel, who will talk about the chemical isolation layer modeling. Danny, you're on mute.
Real quick, you want to unmute yourself?
Well, why would I do that?
All right, your audio sounds
Thank
good. I'm
you.
going to vote control.
Great. Thank you, Deirdre. Well, you've seen a lot of information about the criteria that we'd set for design of a cap. And so I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about what we would do. How would we actually do that design? And that comes into modeling of the cap and using tools that can help look at these predictions 100 years down the road as to whether we're meeting the design criteria. Clearly, we have to do that with a model because it's well beyond our expected professional lifetime, certainly career. We'd hope to live perhaps that long, but again, our professional lifetimes are probably a lot shorter than that, so we have to use a modeling tool. So I'm going to start with a discussion of why we would use a CAP model and why specifically a CAP model rather than other models that might be available, what sort of CAP models are available, and then a few minutes talking about some of the important parameters. We're not going to discuss the specifics of how you would use the model in detail, not give you a guidebook on that at this point. Certainly, more than happy to do that later at another time. But again, right now, it's more about why would we use it and how would we use it in a way that can be effective? And what are the important parameters? And what do we have to be worried about? And what do we really need to focus our attention in trying to define parameters that are important to the model? So, in terms of the modeling, if we should I be able to advance the slides?
Yeah, if you click the screen, that'll take remote control, and now you're moving the mouse, and perfect.
Got it. All right. So, as you've seen from the last few minutes of discussion of the purpose of CAP modeling, we're going to evaluate our ability to meet the design criteria. We're going to ask things like with the model, how thick of a contaminant isolation layer do we need in order to meet that criteria? What should be its composition? Should we need activated carbon? Do we need another sorbent? What if we were using other components in a model? What type of layers? How many layers? Those are things that we could all assess with a modeling tool. We often have things that we're uncertain about. We always will have some parameters that we're uncertain about. Groundwater upwelling, as we'll see, is one of the most important. And we would ask ourselves, well, how sensitive are my is my ability to meet that design criteria? How sensitive it is it to the groundwater upwelling? And is my uncertainty smaller or small enough that we have pretty good confidence in terms of the results? Or is it so sensitive to that parameter that is very uncertain that we lose some of that confidence? So those are things that we can ask with the model. We can also, once we're done with the design and actual construction, we can then start asking questions about whether our monitoring results in the short term describe the same behavior that we were trying to predict with the model. That is, that we may not be able to go all the way to 100 years, but perhaps in a few years, the model results suggest that X, Y, and Z should be the case, and is monitoring data showing exactly that or not? So those are all things that we can do with the model. But why specifically do we look at CAP models rather than all the other models that we have available? Certainly in these sediment water systems, there are surface water quality models and hydrodynamic models that describe what's happening on the water side. There's groundwater models that often describe what's happening on the soil side, at least upland from the sediments. But none of these models, neither of those models, describe in any detail the unique processes that occur in our zone of interest, which are that upper few centimeters of sediment to maybe a meter, where there are a lot of processes that are ongoing. And those processes are some of the most important of those processes are identified here. We can see that there is hyperbaric exchange when we have water, that motion in the overlying water that moves into the surface layers of the sediment. We always have partitioning between contaminant and the sorbent or even the sediment on the chemical isolation layer or in the sediment itself. But also in the near surface, we have bioturbation, the presence of the benthic organisms that interact a great deal with the biologically active zone and change the behavior of the contaminant. The contaminant behavior and transport processes quite significantly. And then we also have a very steep gradient in oxidation reduction conditions that might, for example, isolate metals by forming metal sulfides. And this all happens within the upper few centimeters of sediments. And that's why we have CAP models that describe those processes in detail, that focus on that near surface layer, as well as shown here, deposition and erosion, that it could be very important in terms of long-term effectiveness of a CAP. What about the models that are available? One available that's been available for a long time from the Corps of Engineers is RECOVERY, that breaks the sediment layer into, or breaks the sediment into multiple layers and the CAP into multiple layers, where there is partitioning between dissolved and particulate phases, and there is erosion and deposition that could be simulated, and, as well as burial over time due to deposition. A lot of those processes are shown in this figure. Another model that is used and is commonly used is one that we've developed in our own laboratories, which is CAPSIM. It was alluded to earlier. It actually breaks the sediment up in very much the same way, that is in layers that have their own properties, sediment or cap layers. You have partitioning and other processes that occur between them. There are some differences in that we, in CAPSIM, there's a more specific description of some of the processes in the near surface environment. For example, that hyperreak exchange and bioturbation. But a lot of it is very similar in overall structure. CAPSIM is a little different. It has a graphical user interface, which some people find more convenient. And it does have a lot of capabilities that, quite honestly, a lot of people don't take advantage of, but it is there where you can model kinetics. So, for example, what about granular carbon versus powdered carbon? What will be the difference of sorption kinetics on the behavior of that chemical isolation layer? Chemical reactions, you could actually model with CAPSIM the entire biogeochemistry of the near surface and look at sulfate reduction, for example, that might lead to methylation. So you could model those processes specifically. It does have tools for modeling a lot of the model parameters that are needed, and it also has some commercial CAP materials that are built into the model itself. But it is similar. Both RECOVERY and CAPSIM break the sediment and the caps into multiple layers, and migration through those layers is what it's trying to describe, so that you can define whether you're ultimately successful in meeting your design criteria. What about the importance that you should be focused on, or the parameters that you should be focused on, the inputs that are should be focused on? Certainly, you need to know which contaminants you're going to try to model and what their concentration is. And you can describe them in a sediment concentration typically, or perhaps give pore water concentration, but recognize it's the interstitial water, the pore water, that is carrying the contaminants to the surface typically, because a successful CAP is one that's the sediment itself or the CAP material, the solids aren't moving, but it's moving through the interstitial water, either by diffusion or groundwater upwelling. And so you need to be able to either define a concentration of your contaminants of concern and then the model, or you can provide information to allow to predict what those concentrations are in pore water. That involves the sorption coefficients. So knowing what those might be or how effective a sorbent might be in a chemical isolation layer is equally critical. And then one of the most sensitive site parameters that's important for this migration is the groundwater seepage rate. And we never know it very well. It may vary over time, but you can implement that in the model, even time dependence if desired. And you try to estimate it as best you can, because it is an important parameter, but it's also one of those that we would look for sensitivity analysis, recognizing that it may vary or he may be a somewhat of an uncertain thing, as well as apply conservative by using perhaps higher measured upwelling rates. It is an important parameter. Deposition can be critically important because if there is any significant deposition, a cap life is added to immeasurably. Really, it is a very a strong supporter of sediment cap. Any stability, but also deposition that adds to that stability, can make cap extremely effective. And then, of course, understanding where you're going to be evaluating your design is important because other processes, depending on where that is located, can be important as well. Effectively, if we're near the surface, then your modeling of the behavior in that near surface involves more processes, if you remember back, hyperexchange, bioturbation. Contaminant inputs or model inputs that are less important than those that were on the preceding slide, but can be important, again, are intensity of sediment water exchange. And the reason that I mention that is because if my design evaluation point is near the surface, then that sediment water exchange, as I just mentioned, bioturbation, hyperic exchange, become critically important. If I'm well away from that surface, it may not be important. That's why it's in this second category. Kinetics absorption under the strongly sorbing phase, like remember the granular activated carbon versus powdered carbon, can be important as well, but it is only really important in specific situations where that kinetics can lead to a lack of effectiveness, and not certainly not in every case. And so again, it may be important in a particular situation, usually when you've got a very dynamic system, a lot of groundwater upwelling, trying to put small amounts of carbon in thin layers, that can be important. We often consider our contaminants to not react, although most of them have some degree of reactivity, but we have the most uncertainty in estimating those reactive rates. And so we often don't consider reactivity, but again, we could do that, and that may be important for the long-term success of the cap. I think it's important when you're looking at modeling this that, well, these models, both recovery and CAPSIM, are really one dimension. They're looking at vertical migration up through a cap layer. Capping is an aerial remedy. And so we're looking at using perhaps a conservative representation of this of the entire area. And we're going to model that. And this will be, again, a conservative representation of the entire area. We should recognize, however, that a that if there is a, it's not like a balloon. I always use that example, that if we have some erosion in a small area, we have a cap that is thinner in a particular area, it's not like you're going to let all the gas out of the balloon. You're not going to have a significant impact potentially on a contaminant release. And so even though we're modeling one-dimensionally, we're looking at a particular area, we're trying to do it conservatively. And so that if again, if we have small areas that are not performing as efficient, it may not impact the overall remedy. I mentioned before, near the sediment water interface, there's a lot more processes that are occurring. And so be careful of interpreting concentrations near that cap water interface. What the concentrations near that cap water interface are often completely controlled by that exchange at the surface and controlled by what's happening in the water column. For example, hyperbaric exchange is controlled by behavior in the water column. So you end up with a lot of uncertainty very near the surface. And so again, be very careful and generally try to avoid trying to overinterpret predictions of, in that interface. I would mention though that at the interface, the flux is much less sensitive. The rate of mass transport through that cap layer is much less sensitive to the overlying water dynamics, and it's more controlled by the cap. And so that can be useful even right at the interface when the concentration is not. With respect to this uncertainty and sensitivity, this figure is just to emphasize that where you should put your time and effort is not only on parameters that are uncertain, but parameters that have a large impact in the results as a result of their uncertainty. And so groundwater epiwelling would fit into that category, that the results are sensitive, your design is sensitive to groundwater epiwelling, and if it's very uncertain, you should put a lot of time and effort into that. But those parameters that are less important or of minor importance, so for example, a lot of the processes in the near surface aren't important if my design criteria is a little deeper into the sediments. So even if it's uncertain, it's not having much of an impact and it doesn't fit into that box in the upper right. So again, always focus your attention not only on parameters and conditions and site behavior that is uncertain, but on those that impact your results. This is just a depiction, and you've already seen one, so I don't need to spend any time on it, of kind of showing what, in this case, CAPSIM is predicting. We've got a certain cap configuration, and it's predicting over time the migration of contaminants from the sediment layer up into that, and you can compare that to your criteria, wherever your design evaluation point is. We're now at a point that I'm going to stop talking, and we're opening up for a broader set of questions. With that, let me step back.
All right, thank you so much, Danny. I'm gonna just real quick take back remote control so we don't accidentally advance any slides. So at this time, like Danny mentioned, we are gonna have our first question and answer break. So I'm gonna look to our Q&A pod here and read out those questions submitted by the audience. And then I'll be looking to our trainers or group of trainers here to hop off mute and to provide some responses. So our first question, how do we account for changing design parameter conditions under a transitional climate?
Well, this is Wes. I'll jump off and take a stab at this one, and then if anybody else wants to chime in, you know, please do. But you know, that it's a great question and a really challenging concept. We do speak a little bit to this in the guidance itself. There's a chapter in section 3 of the guidance that talks about some of the potential climate-related or climate change-related impacts or considerations that could be important for CAP design. I think that at a really high level and big picture, it really depends on where you are, where the site is. Different climates, different regions are going to be affected by climate change differently. In some areas, you know, drought and lowering water levels may desiccate cap materials and change the way that they perform. In other areas, rising sea levels and increased precipitation may change some of the fact, you know, the things that we would consider in cap design. So I think there's really a myriad or a range of you know, ways that climate change could affect cap performance over the long term. I think at this point, some of those are just really hard to predict. So maybe I'll leave it there and see if anybody else has a thought.
I just wanted to say that I'd say the biggest challenge with this is defining what the future looks like. If you can define what the future look like in terms of how the conditions are changing, we could certainly incorporate that in our design, our simulations, and try to evaluate those effects. But I do think the biggest problem is trying to define what the future looks like in that particular situation. And it's not one that I think those on the phone can easily answer.
All right. Thank you, Wes and Danny. Next question. Is salinity a factor to be considered for CAP design?
So there's several ways that not salinity directly, but the fact that you are in salt water will affect design. So, for example, The fact that you might be in a salt environment, you might have a great deal more sulfates that would lead to sulfate reduction in the sediments and do a better job of tying up a lot of metals in relatively insoluble metal sulfides. The salt themselves, the only place that that would come into play, the salinity itself, is in certain materials that, such as bentonite, which are not really stable in a saltwater environment. So they could disaggregate, and this could be a bit of an issue if you were trying to, let's say, control permeability using a bentonite material. But there's pretty rare impacts and very specific impacts of salinity.
Great. Thank you, Danny. Next question. Do you typically include sediment deposition into the modeling, or would you exclude that to be more conservative?
If you don't mind, I'll answer this again. And because it ties together the previous question, as well as some comments that I made relative to deposition. One of the biggest challenge with deposition is the confidence that it will continue at some rate into the future. And this is one of the first places that I've seen climate change come into play, is that what this might mean relative to long-term deposition or erosion of a cap. But if you can reach agreement with the stakeholders as to what we think long-term deposition should be, I would certainly recommend that it should be included. We know that it's a fact of life. We know that most of our waterways in the near coastal environment are becoming as depositional, or they are depositing. There is deposition ongoing, but defining what that rate be and what might be a conservative rate is often a challenge. And in the face of uncertainty, oftentimes we default to, well, we're not going to include it then. That's somewhat like reaction. But it does have a big positive impact. I would say at the very least, you should include it as a sensitivity analysis, is that, okay, here's what, if there's no deposition, there's this. If there is deposition, how much better would things be?
Thank you, Danny. Deirdre, I saw you come off mute at some point. Just want to make sure you didn't have anything to add.
No, I was gonna say that a lot of times I might ignore it, but I will also, if we have a strong indication that it is happening, then I might include it as a sensitivity analysis just to show how much more protective this remedy would be. So Danny answered that, so that's why I came off mute.
All right, no worries, just wanted to make sure. All right, next question. For contaminant isolation layer modeling, how do you determine when sorption kinetics is likely to have an effect on cap performance?
And I will answer this. I've focused a lot of attention on this in of late. And I do have some criteria that I begin to use to worry about it when I'm looking at upwelling that is of the order of 10 centimeter a day. And, you know, again, it depends on the contaminant, it depends on the situation. But I would say that the sort of situations where we're applying things like activated carbon, we're often doing hydrophobic organics. And when we see upwelling that's of the order of magnitude of 10 centimeters a day, we see thin layers, perhaps a few inches of chemical isolation layer in a design that seems adequate. And we have small amounts of carbon that we might use, which might be, say, 1% carbon. Those three together would certainly encourage me to evaluate kinetics if I was trying to decide whether I should use, say, powdered carbon versus granular carbon. There's no hard and fast rules. And I think that when in doubt, the thing that you could do with a model such as CAPSIM is evaluate it, again, a sensitivity analysis to see if it is having a significant effect.
Right, thank you, Danny. Keeping with the thread of kinetics, is there guidance on the minimum volumetric fraction of sorptive amendment in an isolation layer that is necessary for adequate contact with the contaminant?
Okay, I'm going to answer this again. The questions are just things that I've faced recently. And so I don't think there's hard and fast guidance of that, but there is ways to, again, evaluate that with the model. You can evaluate the significance of this. It turns out that a lot of that is associated with external mass transfer resistances. So, for example, when we're talking about kinetics, in kinetics evaluations, you can have both mass transfer resistances external to your sorbent and internal to your sorbent. And we do have tools in CAPSIM to try to simulate both. And so it does allow you to evaluate that question. I would say that the biggest issue is often in working with a construction firm is to what is the smallest amount of carbon that I could feasibly place in a particular environment is often the limiting factor, and let's say less important than it's going to force you to have a higher amount of carbon than perhaps the model would suggest you absolutely need.
Right. Thank you, Danny. We've got time for a few more questions that we have in the Q&A pod, and then we'll move on to our content. And just as a reminder for our audience, we will have another Q&A break at the end of our content here today. So we'll have another opportunity to be answering these questions live. All right. So next question. During the construction of the cap layer, do we need to remove the baz and the benthic layer?
Well, maybe I'll go ahead and jump in on this one. Since it's not a topic we'll get into during the construction section next. But typically, I would say the need to remove the BAZ, the biologically active zone, before construction, really that's probably the layer that you're looking to cap anyways. So that's the contaminated layer. So when we do construction, a lot of the benthic organisms, they do readily repopulate over time. And so we're looking to go out and conduct work quickly to get to the end result so that then the clean, healthy benthic community can reestablish on top. It might change, though, in terms of the nature of the organisms that inhabit that BAZ. So as you get to, insects and larvae up to, say, something more like a turtle or other amphibious organisms, things like that, that also dwell in the mud, that there might be efforts to go ahead and salvage those before you start those construction activities. So it really depends on the type of organism and then what your goals are to achieve. And then also think about their protected status as you're developing your design.
Right, thank you, Eric. All right, our last question here, and then we're going to move on. In your experiences, how often can you get answers for the model inputs versus having to make assumptions?
Okay, I wait for somebody else to jump in, but I will say that you're always going to be forced to make some assumptions, and you don't have perfect knowledge on many parts of the modeling exercise or the design or in the entire effort. And you're going to have to use sensitivity analysis to try to address those as well. How sensitive are my conclusions to that assumptions that I'm having to make? Certainly, a number of things you can tie down pretty well with measurements, but those that you can't, again, that's where a modeling tool can be very helpful to evaluate whether how sensitive the results are going to be to that.
Yeah, and I'll just add that I think Danny went over some of the model parameters that seem to have the most influence on the model results. And I think for those, we generally can collect the data to get a more realistic
number to put into the model to reflect those processes or concentrations. He also showed that graphic that kind of showed the sensitivity and uncertainty. And I would say it's for the things that aren't as well known or that we rely on literature for, those probably have a less impact on the conclusions. But again, I'll reiterate what Danny says, and doing sensitivity analyses to understand what that is and how it changes your conclusions is definitely important for developing a robust design.
All right. Thank you so much, trainers, for all those great responses. And thank you to our audience for submitting all those great questions. Again, we will have one final Q&A break at the end of our content modules today. So at this point, we're going to move on to our next section, which is chemical isolation construction considerations with Eric Backham from Moll, Foster, and Lundy.
Great. Well, thank you. You know, as Bhavna and Deirdre and Danny have walked us through so far, you know, we've completed the design. So, you know, that iterative process to get you there, that you have your plans, your specifications, and both of those are supported by a design report. So that package conveys your intent to an agency, but it's also conveying to the contractor what they are to build. And it's very important for this design set to be both constructible and then also clearly communicated. But it doesn't really stop there. We're going to look at some of these construction considerations and methods that you may want to actually consider adding back into your design as you look to issue the final. We're also going to discuss methods for construction quality assurance and quality control, so QAQC for short. For construction, we need to consider it in the order of the materials as they are placed, so bottom up. So first, we've got the mixing consolidation layer or the base layer. The mixing layer forms if that chemical isolation layer materials are placed directly over contaminated sediment, whereas a base layer can be used to prevent that mixing, but you would still need to look at consolidation. The consolidation layer itself then is your clean and unimpacted material. Then it's overlain by potentially filter media, armoring, habitat layers, and then obviously the water column itself. So focusing on the chemical isolation layer placement, one of the big factors that we want to account for in the design phase is calling out the focus on stability as we look at material placement. And we want to have a really even spread so that the loading on that underlying sediment is fairly consistent, and you're wanting to limit those point failures as materials are placed. So this is even more important with soft sediment areas. Coarse sediments can be significantly stronger. So from that, you're going to want to potentially build in lifts and having the recommendations of your geotechnical engineer to inform how you're going to place materials, what kind of lift thicknesses and what kind of consolidation periods are required between lifts. Those are all important. We also want to generally call out for placement riverward to shoreward. And experiences have basically brought up a term for this, but basically looking to control mud waves of contamination that can be moved. So this is destabilized sediment that are result from placing the cap. And you want to control that motion so it's not spreading outside of your cap area, but more importantly, upslope, and so that you will eventually catch up to it and cover that with your materials. We're also looking to place from upstream to downstream, and this is looking just to manage that potential for recontamination of your clean cap areas that result from deposition of contaminated turbidity that may be released from any upstream capping activities. So also of importance is that mixing and consolidation layer. And as I said before, this is the interaction of the chemical isolation layer material and the underlying sediment if there is no base layer. So soft sediment versus coarse sediment, this can drastically change the appearance of that mixing layer. And also whether or not consolidation is happening and dewatering and contamination of your starting clean cap. So it's important a lot of times that we build in an assumption into the design that up to 10% of that chemical isolation layer without a base layer, that up to 10% can be compromised at time equals zero. So you just want to understand on the construction team if this has been considered in the design modeling efforts or if this is something you need to plan around as you look to accommodate final design elevations. Chemical isolation amendments, such as sand with granular activated carbon, powdered activated carbon, organoclays, and others. I want to talk about what's the design dose, both in terms of what the contractor should be planning to achieve, but then they need to specify back to us how they're going to achieve that target dose. And are they going to be adding additional materials or overdosing the amount so that they can accommodate any separation that may occur as it's placed through the water column? Are they going to do other methods to place it, such as lowering the buckets down to the sediment surface or as close to it as they can get to minimize that separation potential? Additionally, we might want to look at the amendment integrity and what's the potential for those amendments to be compromised by the mixing process itself. So as they're amending it for delivery at the site, you know, that's a potentially violent process for something like granular activated carbon that's softer materials. So just understanding how that may change the behavior of your carbon, of your amendments is important. Lastly, I want to encourage folks to really share your knowledge with the contractors, you know, your design team knowledge, other regulatory knowledge of how past projects have gone. Contractors also bring significant experience with other projects that they have. And ultimately, it's a matter of sharing information about your site and your research, collaborating in that pre-construction phase so that ultimately we can get it right the first time. Some of the common placement methods that are used in terms of conventional broadcasting methods. First one on the left is showing the concrete bucket. This is a simple, low-cost method mounted on a crane, but it must have access for a person underneath to open the bucket. So you know, here we can actually see the person in orange opening that. There's issues in terms of lift thickness control. And tracking may be difficult, but oftentimes it may be very implementable for those near shore conditions, placement over armoring systems where you may have a little less sensitivity. Excavators can also be very effective with a smooth lip bucket. And that smooth lip versus the teeth can really affect how material spreads out of the bucket. This is great because it's commonly available equipment. It can work from the shoreline or from a barge. Again, the lift thickness control and tracking can be difficult, but it is manageable based on operator experience and equipment setups for tracking. But you'll also see relatively low production rates because of the size of that bucket. Next, we've got clamshell placement, which is commonly available marine equipment. And here we might have to see how the access to your site is. Is it on a large river system that can support this type of equipment delivery and mobilization? But because of the large bucket, you get much higher production rates. Lift thickness is still tricky, and that more control comes with experienced operators. So you might consider that within your design and specifications. You're also sensitive to overhead obstructions, so bridges and power lines at your site. Maybe something to think about how that is going to impact delivery. Lastly, we're showing conveyed delivery. And this is a commonly available product in more urban areas, where we see aggregate deliveries now with conveyor trucks, also compost spreading for landscape projects. Very low cost, it can be very high production rates and very uniform distribution, at least to the water surface. But as you see here too, you need to have good access for material delivery to maintain those high production rates. Proprietary systems can be highly effective, and but they're unique to each outfit. And we need to be able to evaluate those proprietary systems for our site conditions and maybe even consider pre-placement demonstrations of the technology from that selected contractor prior to allowing them to proceed. So on the left is a hydraulic delivery of materials to the barge from shore, where it's then dewatered and it's spread in a moon pool. That moon pool controls turbidity impacts. It limits the water velocity impacts on the spread of the materials that falls to the water column. It also has shown very high production rates. Because of the large equipment platform that's here, it can be hard to reach tight areas. And then lastly, you will still see the water column effects on the separation of mixed materials, just depending on what your water depth is. Again, since we're spreading right at the surface. On the right, we have a hydraulic spreader where, again, we have the same hydraulic delivery of cap materials, but it's the direct spreading of the slurry rather than dewatering. We see high production rates, hard to reach tight areas because of the size of the equipment platform, but the lack of the moon pool introduces the risk of spreading beyond the target, especially in flowing situations, and we still have those water column effects on the separation of any amendments. So some of the key considerations that are identified in the section here in Table 6-2 are placement accuracy and tracking and the material loss during placement. So placement accuracy and tracking is a very large consideration for pretty much all projects, and you're wanting in the end to certify that placement. Operator experience is a major factor, and ultimately we can't see that final product because we're working above the water and it's being delivered underwater. So the experience with equipment behavior and the ability to rely on their tracking tools is key. Ultimately it gives you the best chance to get it right the first time. Bucket placement methods tend to be less uniform. High accuracy can be achieved with the conveyor delivery and certain proprietary systems, all things to take in mind. Essential quality control measures will be to monitor where are lifts placed, so that tracking component, what quantity is placed. So looking both at time and volume records, but how do you figure out the quantities placed in an individual unit? And then how uniform is the placement? And that's coming out of your quality assurance program. And best practices can include our use of RTK GPS for tracking of where bucket or end of pipe is, routine bathymetric surveys, progression surveys, so you understand where material actually occurs in its final configuration and other unstable surfaces, and then other direct measurement methods that we'll talk about in a little bit. Material loss during placement is another large concern. It typically ends up being a little less of a design concern, except for the downstream impacts. But it is a bigger concern for your contractor since it relates to the material efficiency and overall project cost. It's a function of three factors: the material properties in terms of density, shape, the wetness of the materials, and other things. It's a matter of equipment accuracy and the ability to track it in a repeatable fashion. It's also a matter of the placement conditions. And so if you're in a riverine situation, are you at high flows, low flows? What is your water column depth and how that affects spread as well as distance of travel? So managing material loss, it really comes down to first starting off with realistic expectations that it will happen. You're looking to manage it by evaluating water column dynamics and anticipating how materials might move. And then ultimately continual operator optimization of the placement techniques. So what they start doing at the beginning of your project may not be what they end up doing at the very end when they get to their fully optimized and most efficient placements. So your QA team is needing to be flexible with the contractor, think on their toes with changes in approach. Fine grain and low bulk density materials are more subject to particle drift. So that again, that impacts material loss. So how can you mitigate this? Maybe by limiting fall depth, considering the use of large particle carriers like AquaGate or other aggregate-based products, or even applying biopolymers to help the smaller fine-grain materials stay with sand as it's being placed if it's been mixed. Reactive material separation from the sand during placement can also be controlled by wetting the material to improve the saturability and the bulk density of the material, considering overdosing to achieve the desired mix in place, and then pretty much anything else you can do to get it there. So in addition to the contractor progress measures in terms of area and volume, we need to look for the even distribution of chemical isolation materials, the layer thickness, and the amendment dosage. So this is typically a weight of evidence approach, because as you'll see below, no one measure gives us all the details that we need to certify construction. These QA methods are intended to verify important design and construction specifications, including the uniform delivery of cap material and amendments, as well as the achievement of tolerances. For which you are planning to pay for within the contract and what things you might not be planning to pay for within the contract. So detailed discussion of the pros and cons of each method is described in the guidance section, but some of the highlights below. Bathymetric survey on the left is pre and post capping elevations, as well as intermediate, as often as daily progress surveys. The surface analysis done in-house to determine your thickness and how your contractor is achieving lift controls. It doesn't inform your understanding of consolidation or the amendment distribution. Sub-bottom profiling is the use of sonar to generate contrasting cross-sectional images of the surface and subsurface horizons. This can help you because it does account for consolidation and settling, but it doesn't look at your amendment deliveries. And again, you're looking at a cross section and not an area-wide survey. Sediment profile imaging looks at a cross section of the cap as it's delivered using a prism. And so here you can see point thicknesses. Currently, technology is up to 6 inches. And you can visually assess amendment delivery. Settling pans or rain buckets allow you to retrieve samples of the delivered material. It's placed directly on the cap target. It accounts for material drift and the loss of amendments, but it doesn't assess settlement or mixing and consolidation layer interfaces. And lastly, here are the core collection sediment cores that give you an actual placement and composition in place. You can do a visual and also a chemical assessment of your mixing layer and amendment delivery. It is point by point evaluation. So you're using divers or boats to potentially allow you to collect those sediment cores. Of note, it's the diameter of the core significantly influences the drawdown effect, especially as you're working on soft sediments. So recommend using larger diameter cores, such as 4 inches or more. So to wrap up, if you're to take away anything from our construction consideration sections, I want to reemphasize the importance of evaluating the proposed replacement methods for your project, your site conditions, and your materials. Next would be placing your materials in a controlled manner is essential to preventing the spread of contamination during construction. Then consider how amended layers are to be constructed, how they're mixed, and how they're placed. It's essential to ensure that your amendment delivery occurs. And then last, your quality assurance and quality control measures are an important set of evidence to ensure that the cap meets its design intent and provides a good baseline for future monitoring. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Tamara for a discussion of the monitoring of your sediment cap.
Thanks, Eric. So I'm going to cover this fairly briefly because Deirdre covered a lot of this, and many of the concepts, as you would guess, are intertwined. What you propose to do and what your objectives are guide what it is that you want to make sure that you are monitoring and following up over time. So monitoring is important. There are a lot of reasons here why you would want to make sure that all the work you've done is effective, that your cap is in place, that it's performing as indicated, and also that, you know, you have the data to assure all your stakeholders that the cap is doing what it intended to do in meeting the remedial action objectives, as well as performance targets at the site. So we've seen this graphic before, and again, it all comes down, as Deirdre said, to looking at what, looking at where, and looking at how long. So that should guide what it is that you want to measure specifically. So here, this slide pertains to the sampling depth. What do you want to look at and why? And oftentimes it is really helpful to look at multiple layers within your cap, but certainly you want to look at your erosion protection layer, which is the layer immediately under surface water, and make sure that it is complying with your cap performance objectives. And you can also look deeper down. I mean, as you see here, your chemical isolation layer is the layer immediately above the underlying sediment. That's the contaminated material that you are trying to control mobilization from. And if you see breakthrough there, again, that can be an early warning sign that there may be a problem with the cap performance. So everything you look at has a very specific objective, and it's all going to vary depending on the individual characteristics and objectives at your site. I think we've seen these earlier. They come right out of the guidance document. This can be very, very helpful looking at, you know, what are your chemical of concern concentrations with depth, and you can do that pretty easily with pore water sampling at different depths, vertical profiling. So you can see on the first slide that, I don't know what I did there. Sorry about that. On the first slide, that this is what we want to see. Your cap is performing as designed. Your contaminant concentrations, are basically changing with depth in an appropriate manner. The middle one shows that you have declining performance, that as you get shallower in your cap, your concentrations are not all the way to the left, sort of at the really low or zero, but they're starting to break through. So this shows declining
performance. And then the last one, which again is very interesting, shows that your cap is probably performing well, but that you have recontamination at the surface. And again, you know, this ties into the larger remedial action objectives at the site, and all of those should have considered background and whether background is going to impact your final conditions, because your cap can work really well, but if you have contamination redepositing from other areas, you may not have the optimal conditions that you hope for, even if your design and your construction are perfect. So there's a bunch of different types of media that we can sample to look at cap performance. The first, pore water, we've talked about, and it's really your gold standard because these are chemical isolation caps. So if you have breakthrough, you're going to see it in that soluble phase, and that may be an indicator of migration that you don't want to see. You can also directly sample overlying sediment, or you can actually sample the cap itself. And these are very common, but as we just went over in the previous slide, you have to be careful when you sample sediment, because you don't necessarily know whether that sediment is being impacted by underlying migration from your cap, or whether it is a function of the larger aquatic environment, in which case it doesn't necessarily indicate any relation to performance of your cap. Very common to sample surface water. It's really not easy to tie surface water conditions to your cap, but a lot of times agencies want to see surface water and sediment sampling. That's what they're used to seeing. That's what your investigation baseline had, but you just have to be careful with your interpretation here. Obviously, water is impacted by a lot of different things. And in many systems, there's so much dilution that you don't really know if something you see in surface water can be attributed to a specific source or location. And another thing we see here, biota, and we had a lot of discussion on this in our face-to-face team meetings. You know, we do want to protect benthos. That, as Deirdre said, is a really important criterion and objective. We also want to protect human health and the wildlife environment, which often is traced back to fish concentrations. So there is a general preference on the part of agencies to look at biota. But again, you have to be really careful, because you don't know if what you're seeing is related to the success of your remedy overall, and certainly not specifically the actual isolation performance of your cap. So it's important when you design your monitoring programs to make it very clear, what are you sampling and what does it or does it not tell you about your overall remedial performance? So not only do we need to monitor on some kind of regular basis, which will be determined based on the site conditions, but we also might want to do some repairs. A cap is a constructed item. It's infrastructure, so it needs to be monitored and potentially repaired or amended like any other asset. So I heard a question about climate change. It's certainly one of our strategic arenas that we're looking at. It's very important, and especially when we're dealing with you know, marine conditions, sea level rise is going to be an important consideration. If you have a large storm event or a large change in sea level, you may want to evaluate whether your cap needs a little love. And again, it might just also be observational. Do you see consolidation? Do you see any visible instability or
Do you have evidence of other disturbances, such as vessels or prop wash that could have impacted your cap? It's kind of common sense. The point here is that it's not just like build it and get on, as Danny said, with your retirement. You know, you need to have a continuing team and a plan to make sure that your asset continues to function, and that if it needs a repair or amendment, that it is being performed. So overall, the point here is that you should plan for maintenance just the way you would for anything that you build, and that you should have specific triggers where you might need to take action, and that action could be sampling, it could be repair, or it could just be more observation. And you may need to look with different frequencies over time, depending on the conditions, especially sea level conditions. And another important point to leave you with is that, like with anything else, a small amount of disruption or deviation does not necessarily mean that your entire cap is not functioning or that it's ineffective. So anything you do observe or correct should be put in context of the overall effectiveness of your cap. And with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Wes to wrap up our training here.
Yes, thank you. First, I'd like to thank all the speakers today and really everyone that helped to contribute to the sediment capping guidance. I really hope it's a useful tool for everybody, and I hope this was a useful training for everybody that is in attendance. I'd just like to wrap up with a few thoughts here and then try to get us into Q&A mode. I see there's a lot of really good questions that hopefully we have time to address here at the end. So just as a general recap, our goal with this sediment capping guidance was really to expand upon the 2014 ITRC sediment remediation guidance by developing a comprehensive understanding of the design, the construction, and the long-term monitoring and maintenance of caps, really with a focus on that chemical isolation function. I'm sure many of you today have noticed that that really has been the focus of the conversation. There's been a little bit less focus on things like erosion protection and habitat. As we talked about today, designing the chemical isolation function of a cap is an iterative process. We've seen this graphic here to the right repeated several times today. That iterative process really begins with understanding the remedial goals and objectives for any site, and using those goals and objectives to develop chemical design criteria specific to the contaminant fate and transport processes that we see within a cap. And as Deirdre and Tamara mentioned earlier today, the chemical design criteria are the what, the where, and the when, or for how long, that really serve as the conditions that the design needs to meet to satisfy the remedial objectives. And then once these design criteria are developed, the cap design involves selecting cap materials and thicknesses that will achieve those chemical design criteria. And it's also really important to balance that work with other design factors, such as the physical constraints that may apply to a site, any permitting or regulatory requirements that may apply. And it all has to remain constructible. And so oftentimes the design will need to find a way to achieve, a cap design that can satisfy all of those factors. There's two available modeling tools that have been developed specifically to evaluate or support cap design, and Danny talked about those, Recovery and CAPSIM. Those modeling tools can be used to estimate how various cap configurations and materials will achieve the chemical design criteria. And then, of course, once you're finished with the design, the cap still needs to be built. And as part of that process, it's really important to convey cap construction requirements clearly to contractors and employ construction quality assurance measures that will help verify that the cap is built consistent with the design. Once it is built, it's important to factor in, how the cap will be monitored and potentially how cap performance monitoring might tie into overall remedy effectiveness monitoring. We recommend, and our guidance recommends, the CAP performance data be compared with predetermined maintenance triggers. That was something that Tamara mentioned in her previous slide, really so that it's clear up front what factors are going to be considered when to determine whether or not a CAP needs maintenance, so that we can all ensure that it continues to meet its design objectives. So with that, I'm going to move us to the next slide, and I think that will open up the Q&A here at the end. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much, Wes, and all of our trainers for those wonderful content sections. We're going to, just to be conscious of time, we're going to jump right into our Q&A section, and then I have some quick logistical things to mention before we wrap up today. So our first question, should we set up different layers in the model to account for physical and chemical changes with depth, such as the following? The first example is isolation layer mixing with underlying sediment, which would impact TOC, et cetera. Second example is redox to account for ORP changes with depth, assuming that we have assumed that there's mixing and redox has reached equilibrium in the model. And I'd be happy to repeat that because I know that was 8 years ago.
So this sounds like a question about modeling. I think Danny has jumped off and I can't turn my camera on. It's telling me no, but I would say to me, if I understand this question, it's asking it, you know, it says, should we do something? To me says, I think it is possible with the modeling tools like CAPSIM that you can develop as many layers as you want, but should you do that ultimately comes down to the specifics of the problem you're trying to solve. So is it worth the extra time and effort of putting those layers? And do you really have the information needed to do that? And which really is going to be specific to your site and the amount of budget that you have to work with and how important you think those changes are going to be. You know, do you maybe want to run a sensitivity analysis and see if those assumptions are important? So that would be my thoughts on that. And I'm sure there are others that would want to jump in on some of these.
Yeah, I'll jump in on the isolation layer mixing with the underlying sediment part of this, which it says it impacting TOC. A lot of times, you know, if you have softer sediments and if mixing with the underlying sediments in, you know, a significant amount, not just like a, you know, centimeter or an inch, a lot of times I might actually ignore that in the modeling. So, for example, if I plan to place a foot, I might actually say, well, instead of simulating 12 inches, I might simulate 10 inches if I really know that's going to happen. Because in addition to the TOC affecting it, you're also going to get the contaminants affecting it, right? And so it's no longer sort of like that clean cap. The other way I've also handled it is by sort of putting a specific layer in there and accounting for that TOC and accounting for those concentrations. If I think it would be helpful, that kind of goes into what Dave was saying about is it worth it?
All right. Thank you, Dave and Deirdre. Next question. How can we maintain surface quality in the presence of anthropogenic impacts?
I can probably take a stab at that, and I'm sure that there's others. I think what the question is asking is really protecting the CAP, making sure that anthropogenic activities like anchoring or prop wash aren't going to affect the permanence of the CAP. And if I'm wrong, you know, definitely chime or ask the question again. But there's a lot of ways, you know, that we can try to account for anthropogenic impacts if we can anticipate them. We can include some consideration of those impacts in the design of the CAP. And so really when we're thinking about erosion protection design, that's where we can anticipate things like prop wash and also natural forces, you know, wind and wave action, stuff like that, so that we can try to build in some level of planning for the type of forces the CAP will be subjected to and then design against those. There's also institutional controls that can be implemented to try to restrict some of those activities. And so if you don't want somebody dropping an anchor on top of your CAP, you can put up signage or implement some other type of control for that. ultimately, it's going to come down to monitoring, right? I mean, you're going to want to monitor to make sure your cap is remaining in place, and that those factors have not affected it. The cap quality, and then determine whether or not maintenance is needed if you do see an issue come up.
I might add on to that too. I think Wes grabbed all the points I was thinking of, with the exception of one, is also just considering the types of activities in your area. So if you are in a highly industrial area or near the navigation channel, you might also want to consider the potential for impacts of the cap. And again, those are super hard and rare to foresee, but you might want to at least identify a response program for how will you respond, what types of investigations might you look at, but really have that response program in mind so that if the worst happens, people aren't delaying on getting out to assess the condition.
All right, thank you, Wes and Eric. All right, I'll move on to the next question. Do our trainers here today have any thoughts on geosynthetic or geotextile over the sediments in place of the mixing consolidation layer?
I thought I might chime in on that one, although I'm sure Eric can handle this one just as well as I can. But the short answer is that is yes, that geosynthetics and different types of materials have been used on numerous designs. When you talk about the mixing layer, it's usually for geotechnical purposes because you have soft sediments, right? And you don't want the cap to essentially sink into the sediments on a non-uniform basis. But they're also sometimes employed over the isolation layer to mitigate the impact that, armor layers might have in sinking down into the isolation layer. So the only caveat or qualification I'd put on that is that generally they're very difficult to place in the water. And they're very difficult to place in particular in moving water, like in a river type environment. A geosynthetic, turns into an underwater sail, so it can be very challenging, usually require divers. So a lot of times installation is more expensive. They require very specific overlaps, which, make, placing it more difficult. So generally, it's more cost effective and easier to use bulk materials, placing them in the water, than using geosynthetics or other type of mats or other type of materials. But it's not always the case, So and they have been used effectively in many situations.
And I 100% agree with what John said, and I'll also point out another concern with products can be, how they act as a potential slip plane when you do look at riverbank and slopes near shore and different types of materials. The finer grain materials may not stick as well and be more likely to fail because you've placed that geosynthetic, which changes the roughness at that interface. But if there's a need for a low profile cap, you may look at a composite type of mat and then just be directly overlaying it with riprap or other things to help keep it in place and be less sensitive to that same type of failure. So it really depends on your situation. But it, as John said, it's going to be more expensive and difficult to place.
All right. Thank you, John and Eric. Next question. Are there specific geotechnical data needs for determining the best placement method, such as sampling for shear strength?
And this one, I would recommend folks spend time in the expanded discussion in section 6, as well as the data needs section 4. We do go into that a little bit. It definitely depends on your geotechnical engineer's experience. I'm not a geotechnical engineer, but I rely on them heavily as we prepare those designs. And so the shear strength is important to look at, as well as the ability to for that sediment to dewater and consolidate in developing that lift placement strategy as they go through. What's the general bearing strength of that sediment? I think that you're getting out of the shear strength. So I think that's one of the primary considerations.
All right. Thank you, Eric. All right. Next question. Any experience with the use of binders to minimize reactive material separation from amended sand during placement?
Okay, seeing no one else jumping in right away, you know, I think binders are something that I think is developing. I've seen it more in terms of commercial products, and we are reviewing it for use on a site. And I think it comes down to demonstration and making sure you understand it for your materials. So what type of amendments are you using? Are you using it strictly for amendment delivery or turbidity controls? But then also, are there other materials that, you know, essentially employ binders, like the aggregate carriers and aqua gates and other products like that, that, you know, are also used for delivery? So I think it's a very site-specific use. And I don't know if others on the panel have experiences to share with binders in the field yet.
Great. Thank you, Eric. No other trainers are jumping in for this one. I'll move on to another question. How is consolidation addressed in cap design and performance?
I can jump in from the chemical isolation part of things, and maybe someone else can jump in from a physical standpoint. We often consider consolidation when designing the chemical isolation layer in the model. It actually ends up acting like an additional seepage or an additional pore water expression. So as the cap is put down on the sediments are then squeezed, that pore water has to go somewhere. And so in the model, it basically increases that Darcy flux for a certain period of time. So when you do your consolidation evaluations, you often come up with how much sediment is going to consolidate and over how much time it's going to take to consolidate. And those two parameters do go into the model to address that part of it. But I'll rely on someone else to talk about the physical pieces of it.
And I would say the physical piece comes down to during construction, consolidation, and judging contractor performance. It entirely depends, I think, on the design and the specifications and how that contract is structured. But in very soft sediments, you can have a lot of consolidation, and that consolidation can increase as you place more and more materials. So if you are looking to achieve a design grade for your cap that you want, that you've specified final elevations, you may be at it for a while looking to achieve those final elevations. So it is best if you want to finish the job and not have a lot of quantity overruns with your contractor and change order discussions, to include an assessment of the cap thickness, so the thickness of the material that is placed overall. And that's, again, where it comes down to what are the QC methods, and can you use those rain buckets or sediment cores to assess that point-specific thickness to demonstrate the satisfaction of your design.
I guess I'll chime in real quickly. Just from a pure materials perspective, you know, it is possible to take a look at whatever materials you're placing and evaluate them based on, you know, wet bulk density and, you know, density factors. And we try to provide some of that information, you know, for materials that, you know, that we supply in advance. It's so there is some reliability of what that layer, target layer thickness is going to be on an as place basis. But things like armor layers and other overlying materials, even the depth of the water, are going to influence consolidation to a significant extent. So it's a good question. We haven't seen huge variations in cap thickness based on consolidation. But it's something that could be looked at outside of the capping realm.
All right, thank you, trainers. We have one final question, and then I will wrap up the training here with some logistical key messages, and then we'll be on our way. So our last question for today is, I study bioturbation of microplastics in sediment and their movement into aquifers in lentic ecosystems. I'm interested in what factors could most influence sample collection, and if you have any advice on sample preservation so that each layer can be separately analyzed in the laboratory.
I'll give an example of a project I worked on where we were trying to really understand depth of bioturbation. We collected sediments in a lake that had really soft sediments, and so this was a challenge. And what we did was we collected cores, but then we kept them in a vertical position, and we put them in a kind of cooler vertically with dry ice. So we actually froze them in their position, and that allowed us to then, you know, move the core around, put it on its side, slice it open, and then get a little bit more precise in kind of those depths and looking at things. So that's one example I have that was useful in preserving sample.
All right. Thank you, Deirdre. So with that, I'd like to just thank everybody for joining us today. And I'd like to say a special thank you to our expert trainers for giving us their time, not only to create this training, but to see it through. We would love to hear back from everybody today. So please be sure to fill out the feedback form online. Its link is here on the last slide. It is also located on the Clumen training page that did bring you here today. So the feedback form is also how you would receive a certificate of completion if you're interested. You'll fill out that feedback form, check a box to certify that you participated, and then a certificate will be emailed to you. So with that, I'd like to thank everybody again and wish you a wonderful rest of your day. Trainers, thank you so much. You'll be hearing from me in an email.